you go on 42nd Street and you can see the guys playing three-card Monty and sharking the tourists. Well, we've got a president doing a three-card Monty on us.
Dialogue is the essence of civilization. To settle things non-violently, to settle things by persuasion, by understanding, by creating compromises.
The trade-off has been that we will impose on foreign nationals from Arab and Muslim countries for our security.
Mr. Bush makes it quite clear that all he needs in order to start bombing Iraq is to know that Saddam is a really nasty man and that he's weapons of mass destruction, even if no one can find them.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, January 31st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The sudden expulsion of families from a 20-mile border strip between the autonomous Kurdish North and the rest of Iraq has led to speculation that President Saddam Hussein is clearing a buffer zone to defend against a U.S. invasion from the north. Within the last 10 to 15 days, Baghdad has reportedly moved forces of the Mujahideen, a militant Iranian opposition group under Saddam's control, near the boundary with the Kurdish zone. That's according to an official of the Kurdistan Democratic Party. On Capitol Hill yesterday, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage responded to questions from senators in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel asked about the administration's timetable for an attack on the Iraqi people.
If inspections go forward, which I assume they will, but what then is the time frame? Are we going to lay down, the United States lay down in the Security Council a time frame? All right, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we go to war?
As President said, Senator, no decision has been made. However, he has instructed us to engage for the next few weeks in intensive diplomacy to try to resolve this peacefully. So I think the best time frame I can give you is this is a matter of weeks and not months, sir.
Peace Watch commentator Terry Jones sympathizes with the Bush administration's desire to act preemptively.
I'm really excited by George Bush's latest reason for bombing Iraq. He's running out of patience, and so am I. You see, for some time now, I've been really pissed off with Mr. Johnson, who lives a couple of doors down the street. Well, him and Mr. Patel, who runs the health food shop, they both give me queer looks, and I'm sure Mr. Johnson is planning something nasty for me, but so far I haven't been able to discover what it is. I've been around his place a few times while he was away, just to see what he's up to. But he's got everything really well hidden away, and that's how devious he is. As for Mr. Patel, don't ask me how I know. I just know from very good sources that he is, in reality, a mass murderer. I've leafleted the whole street, telling them that if we don't act fast, he'll pick us all off, one by one. Now, some of my neighbours say, if I have proof, why don't I go to the police? But of course, that's simply ridiculous. The police will say they need some stupid stuff like evidence or a crime to charge Mr. Johnson with or Mr. Patel with. They'll come up with endless red tape and quibbling about the rights and wrongs of a preemptive strike. All the while, Mr. Johnson will be finalising his plans to do terrible things to me, and Mr. Patel will be running around secretly murdering people. Well, since I'm the only one in the street with a halfway decent range of fully automatic firearms, I reckon it's up to me to keep the peace. But up until now, that's been a bit difficult. Now, however, George W. Bush has made it clear that all I need to do is run out of patience, and then I can wade in and do whatever I want. And let's face it, Mr. Bush's carefully thought-out policy towards Iraq is certainly the only way to bring about international peace and security. The one certain way to stop Muslim fundamentalist suicide bombers targeting the US or the UK is to go and bomb a few Muslim countries that have never threatened us. Exactly. That's why I want to go and blow up Mr. Johnson's garage and kill his wife and children. Strike first. That's the only way to teach him a lesson. Then he'll leave us in peace and quiet and won't go around peering at me in that totally unacceptable way. Mr. Bush makes it quite clear that all he needs in order to start bombing Iraq is to know that Saddam is a really nasty man and that he's weapons of mass destruction, even if no one could find them. And I'm certain I've just as much justification for killing Mr. Johnson's wife and children as Mr. Bush has for bombing Iraq. Mr. Bush says his long-term aim is to make the world a safer place by eliminating rogue states and terrorism. Oh, it's such a clever long-term aim, because how can you ever know when you've achieved it? How will Mr. Bush Bush know when he's wiped out all the terrorists? When every single terrorist is dead? But then a terrorist is only a terrorist once he's committed an act of terror. What about all those other would-be terrorists who are just about to commit the next acts of terror? Those are the ones you really want to eliminate, since most of the already known terrorists, being suicide bombers, have already eliminated themselves. So perhaps Mr. Bush will need to wipe out everyone who could possibly be a future terrorist. Maybe he can't be sure he's achieved his objective until every single Muslim fundamentalist is dead. But then some moderate Muslims might convert to fundamentalism. Maybe the only really safe thing to do would be for Mr. Bush to eliminate all Muslims. Well, this is what I propose doing in my street. Mr. Johnson and Mr. Patel are just the tip of the iceberg. There are dozens of other people in the street who I don't like and who, well, quite frankly, look at me in odd ways. No one will be really safe until I've wiped them all out. Now, my wife says I might be going a little too far, but I tell her that I'm simply using the same logic as the President of the United States. That shuts her up. If George W. Bush can publicly state that Saddam Hussein is the most likely person to supply al-Qaeda with weapons of mass destruction without anyone laughing in his face, then I can say that Mr. Johnson down the road is actually an alien who has designs on the whole planet. Well, I know it might be a bit hard to believe when you see him trimming his hedge, but it's just as likely as Saddam's secularist Islamic regime giving aid to a terrorist group belonging to a strict fundamentalist sect like the Wahhabis, or Salafis as they prefer to be called. Like Mr. Bush, I've run out of patience. And if that's a good enough reason for the president, it's good enough for me. I'm going to give the whole street 2 weeks, no, 10 days, to come out in the open and hand over all aliens and interplanetary hijackers, galactic outlaws and interstellar terrorist masterminds, and if they don't hand them over nicely and say thank you, I'm going to bomb the entire street to kingdom come. Why, it's just the same as what George W. Bush is proposing. And unlike what he's intending to do, it'll only destroy one street.
Terry Jones's commentaries are featured in the London Observer. He's also well known as one of the cast members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. United Against Iraq, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair reviewed possible timetables for diplomacy in war today, despite calls by allies to give weapons inspectors more time to disarm Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. The leaders, buffeted by critics at home and abroad, hope to come to terms on how soon to abandon diplomacy for war if Iraq does not disarm. They also were set to discuss a potential second and final UN resolution against Saddam. Echoing Bush's hardline views, Blair said shortly before the talks that Iraqis must provide 100% cooperation to UN inspectors. It's absolutely clear they're not, he said. Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of State Colin Powell set the stage, painting a grim picture of Saddam's regime hours before the White House meeting. He could decide secretly to provide weapons of mass destruction to terrorists for their use against us, Cheney told a gathering of top Republicans. This enemy is not an enemy you can deter. This is an enemy we must destroy, he said. With Britain's backing, the United States has threatened to use force to disarm Iraq if it does not give up its chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons programs, as required by a UN Security Council resolution passed in the fall. Blair's allegiance to Bush has cost him considerably in the British press, where he's often referred to as Bush's poodle. During a recent anti-war rally in Washington, D.C., British Parliament member Jeremy Corbyn addressed the crowd of nearly 500,000 and stopped by the Pacifica broadcast booth for a discussion. We asked him about the political cost to Blair in supporting Bush's war. I was joined by radio co-host Laura Flanders of Working Assets and guest analyst Phyllis Bennis. Jeremy Corbyn.
Firstly, British public opinion is overwhelmingly against the war with Iraq, and indeed overwhelmingly critical of the close relationship that Tony Blair has with George Bush. And in a recent BBC poll, it said 97% of the population thought he was too close to Bush, 80% are opposed to the war, and nearly 50% are opposed to the war under any circumstances, UN approval or not. So the opposition is big. The background analysis has to be that Britain and the United States have militarily been very close. And as British military and economic power has declined over the past 70 years or so, British prime ministers have sought to feel strong by the close relationship with the USA. And after September the 11th, Tony Blair said we have to stand shoulder to shoulder with the USA. in grief, yes, of September the 11th, but many of us had severe doubts about the campaign in Afghanistan, the bombing of Afghanistan, in which 8,000 at least died. That hasn't brought back any of those others who died on September the 11th. And now the war with Iraq. Why? One, it's a military close relationship, but Blair this time seems to me to have misjudged it badly. Even within the Labour Party, of which I'm a member, there is overwhelming opposition to the war with Iraq, and amongst Labour members of Parliament, many of whom did support the war in Afghanistan do not support the war in Iraq.
With respect to the kind of protest that you're seeing in England and the UK, you talked about CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. There were some extraordinary actions in the last week by people actually breaking in, I understand, to nuclear power plants. Sellafield, was it? What happened?
Sizewell in Suffolk. There was a break-in by people who demonstrated against nuclear power and against nuclear weapons. We also had two railway train drivers in Scotland who refused to take a train out of the depot because it was carrying ammunition to be loaded on ships to be taken to the war in the Gulf. And anti-war movement's enormous.
Just to respect to that break-in at Sizewell, if you could describe it, it was not just that they penetrated the perimeter, they actually got to the large reactor plant, as I understand
it. They got right through to the reactor plant, and this sent sort of paroxysms of concern through the hierarchy in the British establishment, thinking, goodness, how do these people get in and what are they trying to do, and couldn't a terrorist do the same? Whereas the point they're making is that, yes, these things are incredibly vulnerable, but nuclear power is very dangerous for all of us. And why do we have nuclear power? It's the most expensive, most subsidised form of electricity generation in Britain, basically because without the nuclear power programme, you could not get plutonium for nuclear weapons.
We just heard a contingent go by with a large sign saying we want the U.S. military troops out of the Philippines and Korea. It speaks to the policies of the U.S. government that have brought us to this demonstration today. Any reaction to that, Phyllis Bennis or
Corbyn? I was just going to ask Jeremy Corbyn if you could talk a little bit about this whole phenomenon that we're seeing of the globalization of this anti-war movement. We're seeing a scenario where governments around the world are facing huge challenges between having to juggle their dependence on the United States, whether it's for military support or economic support, particularly in the Middle East, but in Europe as well, while they have populations massively opposed to that alliance. How is that playing out in Britain or elsewhere in Europe, where governments are faced with this widespread opposition and yet are eager to appear to be part of the Bush camp?
Two things. Firstly, I think we should remember the very serious erosion of civil liberties that's taken place in the past 18 months. In the United States, obviously, with the special courts that have been brought in and the use of Guantanamo Bay with no legal basis whatsoever. In Britain, anti-terrorist laws have been brought in, which, whilst not quite as draconian as the American ones, aren't far off it, allow the Home Secretary to imprison people without charge or trial indefinitely, foreign nationals. And this has happened all over. Secondly, the opposition to the war is an opposition, yes, to a war with Iraq. And I've been at rallies in all over Britain, obviously, United States. I've been in Paris. I've been in Madrid. I've been in Istanbul. I've been in Athens. I've been at a lot of anti-war activities. And I was in Australia for a funeral when the first big demonstration took place in autumn of 2001. What we're seeing is, I think, a change in the protest movement in that, yes, it's against wars and against militarism, but it's also part of a global view that we cannot go on with the world, a quarter of the population living in desperate poverty and starvation, 30% more having a declining living standard, falling life expectancy in worse conditions. Yet the world's economic institutions, primarily dominated by the United States with the support of Britain and others, insisting on free market economic policies to the poorest countries in the world. And so again, we're all then putting up shutters, barbed wire shutters around ourselves to keep out the economic migrants created by this economic system. There is no future and stability in mass armament by ourselves in order to keep people poor.
Mm. So the movement that's emerging internationally is really a movement very much against that growing economic and military empire as much as it is the particularity of this war.
Absolutely. We formed our group as Stop the War Coalition because we were against the war with Afghanistan, but we recognized, particularly since President Bush's Axis of Evil speech, that this was a man who would go anywhere, anytime, any place for any war, and we're not prepared to be part of that. I'm excited by the coalitions, but what I've also realized that we're developing a new politicization of a generation that was depoliticized under Reagan, under Thatcher, and traumatized by the end of the Cold War, traumatized in the sense of becoming inactive. What we're now seeing is a new idealism emerging, and in Britain it's the first time there's been a multi-ethnic peace movement, and that's very welcome.
British Parliament member Jeremy Corbyn speaking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies and radio host Laura Flanders of Working Assets at the Pacifica broadcast booth during the anti-war rally in Washington, January 18th. While the U.S. continues to build its armies in the Middle East, preparing to resume its attack on Iraq, there is another war going on much closer to home, specifically in Venezuela, who up until a few years ago was considered our ally. As a member of OPEC, we relied on Venezuela to make up the difference. However, in recent years, the U.S. has changed its policies towards our former ally. According to political activist and author Greg Palast, the U.S. has tried to undermine the government of Hugo Chavez and have characterized him as a carbon copy of Saddam Hussein. Peace Watch spoke with Greg Palast recently about his book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and the connection between Saddam Hussein and Venezuela President Chavez.
Well, I mean, the only relationship they have is that you know, Chavez, as president of the OPEC conference, met with every president of every member nation, and that included his meeting with Saddam Hussein. But he's actually made very clear, one thing that was very interesting about Chavez, he was one of the first people who just came down very hard in no uncertain terms on the attackers when America was attacked on September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
In unequivocal terms, he's an anti-terrorist. The second is that he told me that he actually contacted George Bush and said, listen, I am not going to allow OPEC to be used as a political economic weapon against the United States. And he tried to speak reason to Bush because he told me he got along well with Bill Clinton. And by the way, he got along very well with W's daddy.
Mm-hmm.
An oil man, and they got along. Senior Bush gets along with Chavez, but remember, he's from a much more establishment end of the family. The idea that Junior, our current president, is just a repeat of the old Bush is, I think, a little off base. Hugo Chavez is a very good friend of Bill Clinton, who had been a supporter. He's not an enemy of the United States. This is all brand new stuff ginned up by the current administration, and unfortunately swallowed whole by the Washington Post, New York Times. Until George W. got in office, you never heard negative stuff about Hugo Chavez when Clinton was in. This was our close ally.
And so how does you said that George W. Bush wants to smash OPEC,
yes,
basically. And how does Venezuela factor into his plans to do
well,
that?
Well, if you've taken Iraq out of OPEC, first you burn down their fields and you rebuild it under American and British oil companies, which are locked out right now. You know, it's now French, German, and Russians have control. So you rebuild in Iraq outside of OPEC, just as we did with Ecuador. You take Venezuela out of OPEC, and the guys that were attempted to overthrow Chavez and still are trying to overthrow Chavez and are very open about it, the one way they're trying to curry U.S. support is saying that they would leave OPEC.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big part of the bigger international oil picture. And you can't understand what's going on in Iraq unless you really follow what's happening in Venezuela. In fact, to some extent, you know, that's our real target. I mean, you don't get much news about Venezuela unless you're listening to a Pacifica affiliate, and bless you for trying to get this word out, or unless you listen, of course, to BBC television, my programs, or others, because the rest of the world is kind of interested in what's going on there. But, you know, Americans are getting so distracted with Iraq, they don't understand what's going on behind the Wizard of Oz's curtain in South America.
And your research and your assessment of it is basically that in order to smash OPEC, President Bush, George W. Bush, is trying to extract Iraq and Venezuela out of that whole equation so that he has access to the millions of oil that is produced by those two countries.
Millions of barrels a day. And the case of Venezuela, we got Conoco, Phillips, we've got ExxonMobil in there, and plus they just, and British Petroleum, which, by the way, is as much American as it is British, because it's the they control the Alaska oil system. And these are the controllers of Venezuela oil, and they just feel like they're losing control to this guy Chavez, who's now passed another law saying he's doubling the royalties on oil companies. Now, that's not a way to make friends with Tony Blair, who's very close to British Petroleum, or with George Bush, who's close, of course, to ExxonMobil, which after Enron was his biggest was the biggest donor to his political career.
Well, we see where Bush is headed with Iraq. I mean, clearly the troops are in the region. What do you expect are his possibilities in terms of Venezuela and accomplishing?
Well, I have a very, unfortunately, I have a very dark view of it. And I even bluntly discussed with Chavez that I thought that the, with the president of Venezuela, that I thought that the smart move by his opponents would be to kill him. He's a very popular personal guy, and there's really no heir apparent within his political movement. And that makes him a very vulnerable cat. And if we're going, if we do invade Iraq, I'm not sure who we are, but if we do, I would very much fear for Hugo Chavez's life, because the cameras will be all in the Mideast, the papers will be all caught up in the Mideast, and he won't have the protection of public scrutiny. And so I think that we're looking at another coup attempt, and probably this time an assassination attempt.
Okay. Greg Palast, any final thoughts on your part?
Well, if you want to actually see what you're not allowed to see on U.S. TV, and you want to take a look at what people are seeing worldwide on BBC Nightly News and Television Newsnight, go to my website, which is gregpalast.com. That's GREGPALAST.com. And on the left side of the homepage, you can click on the real video, and most computers will play the my reports from Venezuela, as well as you can read my comments and most of my hour-long interview with President Chavez on my website. And, you know, I'm going to have, in a couple of weeks, we're going to have the new American edition of my book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, will be out in paperback, and that has a brand new section on Venezuela. So, you know, you can listen to Dan Rather's version or Silence on Venezuela, or you can pick up a wider view that the rest of the world is seeing.
Greg, we've interviewed a number or some politicians who say that those who think that this war is about oil are just foolish or naive and uninformed. And we suspect that the president is going to try to convince the American public that it's not blood for oil. What would your single response be to those who are?
Well, it's being sold to us as part of fighting the war on terror. But the, you know, it's a great three-card Monty job. I've moved from London to New York, and you go on 42nd Street, and you see the guys with the playing three-card Monty and sharking the tourists. Well, we've got a president doing a three-card Monty on us by saying, oh, there's Osama bin Laden, there's terrorists out there. And there really are. I mean, it's no joke that we really were attacked. But somehow, instead of finding Osama bin Laden and smashing al-Qaeda, which we seem incapable of doing, we're getting distracted. We're getting distracted by our president playing Lawrence of Arabia in Iraq.
Greg Palast, political activist and author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy.
Tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for. The generals want to hear the end game. The allies want to prove the plan. But the oil men in the White House, they just don't give a damn. It's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil. Don't give me no shit about blood, sweat, tears, and toil. It's all about the price of oil. Sought this out last time. Was he less evil then than he is now? The stock market.
And now, by taking the president's speech out of context, California artist Steve Craig put into context what Bush has been pushing since 9/11, and that's fear.
We refuse to live in fear. We refuse to live in fear. 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 Fear.
Is terror.
Fear.
Is terror. Is terror.
Threats.
Fear. Sudden terror.
Thousands of trained killers are plotting to attack us.
Fear.
Diseases.
Bomb making.
Poisons.
Deadly gases.
To attack America.
To attack America.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Chemical and biological weapons. And
atomic weapons.
Weapons of terror.
Terrible weapons.
Hostility.
Dangerous
weapons.
Deadly biological agents.
Go about your lives.
Mustard gas.
Sarin nerve gas.
VX nerve gas.
Fear.
Instruments of terror.
The instruments of mass death.
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 And destruction.
Nuclear weapon.
A mushroom cloud.
Life seems almost normal.
Brutal and lawless.
Cruel.
Violence
and aggression.
Secure the peace.
Keep the peace.
Terror and murder.
Threat to peace.
We want peace.
There can be no peace.
Homicidal dictator.
Threaten America.
Enriching uranium for a bomb.
Nuclear holy warriors.
Pay attention to your surroundings.
Danger.
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 I want you to report it immediately.
Fear.
30,000 liters. Of anthrax.
Anthrax.
Terror.
Dominate the Middle East.
Nuclear weapons.
Horrible poisons.
Gases.
Fear.
Terror.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Massive stockpile of biological weapons
capable of killing millions.
Kill thousands of people.
Killed or injured at least 20,000 people.
Deliberate deception.
A method of intimidation.
Fear.
Blackmail.
Threat.
Future of fear.
Developing a nuclear weapon.
America is a friend to the people of Iraq.
We will act with the full power of the United States military.
We want peace.
No peace,
friend.
War.
Hostility.
Peace.
No peace.
Attack the enemy.
Attack the enemy.
Attack the enemy.
The situation could hardly get worse.
We will spend less on overhead and more on protecting America.
Future of fear.
Terror.
Enemies.
New threats of the 21st century.
Thank you for listening.
Good night, and may God bless America.
Fear.
King George and the Administration of Fear was produced by Steve Craig, an artist living in Los Angeles, who sees no justification for war with Iraq. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.